Welcome to Cogitations, a show where each week your host, anthropologist and UC Davis faculty Tarek El-Haik, encounters and talks with fellow thinkers, composers, philosophers, visual artists, filmmakers, and media scholars who cogitate with images, concepts, and forms. These cogitations are more than reflections. They are an expression of a way of life, an antidote to our dimmed access to the infinite, and an invitation to a joyful experience of our finitude. The show takes its name from a concept that has been key in both the philosophical work of the 12th century polymath Averroes and the interplanetary music of composer Sun Ra. Cogitations sound like the enchanting voices, songs, and music of birds of flames that have entered into our dark world. So welcome to Radio Cogitation number 3. I hope everyone is doing well. Things are still in flux and we have no idea at this point where things are going, but we hope that things will improve in coming weeks and in coming months. The theme for today's show is A World Without Football, and I'm very, very pleased to welcome my guest Luca Caminati, who's joining us from Montreal in Canada to talk about our love and passion, our common love and passion for football, and to think a little bit about what it might be to console ourselves in a world that is in which football has been removed from our sight and the experience of football itself. So before I welcome officially Luca Caminati, I would like just to introduce my guest. Luca is a professor of film studies at Concordia University in Montreal. He's the author of Orientalismo Eretico, Pier Paolo Pazzolini e il Cinema del Terzo Mondo, Heretical Orientalism, Pier Paolo Pazzolini and Third World Cinema, published in 2007. Then he also authored Cinema as Happening, Pasolini's Primitivism and the 60s Italian Art Scene, published in 2010. And Roberto Rossellini, a documentary maker, Una Cultura della Realtà, a Culture of Reality, along with many articles and book chapters. In 2009-2010, Luca Caminati was the recipient of the Paul Mellon National Endowments for the Humanities Rome Prize, a residential fellowship awarded by the American Academy in Rome. His current project, titled Traveling Auteurs, The Geopolitical Afterlife of Postwar Italian Art Cinema, investigates the travel films of Italian auteurs. And more recently, with James Cahill, he is currently editing a collection titled Cinema of Exploration, Essays on an Adventurous Film Practice, and it's forthcoming with Routledge. So, welcome to the show, Luca.
Thank you, Tarek. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to have you here. So, before we get to Pasolini and before we get to Pasolini's complex and fascinating relationship to football, or soccer, as it is called in North America, it would be interesting to just talk a little bit about how this COVID-19 outbreak and pandemic is affecting us as football lovers. And so the way I experience at least this particular moment is to witness every day, time and again, as we listen to the news, as I listen to the news pertaining to the world of football, that we are dealing with interruptions of the transfer market. There's a great deal of talk about the effects of this outbreak on and confinement in particular on athlete health routines, and the impact on this confinement on both the corporeal and incorporeal lives of players. Then you have all of the polemical attempts and resistance from certain clubs to accept the suspension of national leagues and regional Champions Leagues, from Copa America to the European Champions League. And then, of course, there are those who are benefiting from these interruptions, at least at the sports level, perhaps not at the economic level. I'm thinking in particular at Maradona's
you know, team, or which is called Club Gimnasia de la Plata, which is, you know, was basically bound to be relegated. And I'm sure that he's quite happy that, you know, the league has been interrupted and that his team will remain in the Primera División. So we have all of these different kind of news that are coming from the world of football. Recently, I was looking at a discussion between Megan Rapinoe and who's the world champion with the U.S. women national football team, and she's been posting Zoom videos of her conversation with the Congress U.S. representative Alessandra Ocasio-Cortez, in which they discussed the social inequities, you know, that were laid bare by this crisis. Anyhow, and how are you dealing with this situation in relationship to this particular world of football?
Well, Tarek, I am in the Maradona camp because my team, Genoa Football and Cricket Club, was actually on the verge of being relegated after a disastrous championship. And the two options that we had in Italy at the moment, that is to say either Juventus or Lazio winning the championship, were both, for me, absolutely terrible. So on a strictly partisan term, I'm actually kind of happy for this suspension. So I side with Maradona on this. The World Without Football is a beautiful title, and thank you for inviting me to talk about it. I never really thought about this until you mentioned it. So thank you for asking me to think about this world without football. So what am I missing are a series of things. The first, of course, is the friendship and the community that comes with it, right? That includes you. I mean, a lot of our interaction has somewhat football in it. Not because I don't think neither of us are football fanatics, but they are such a big part of our life that, you know, inevitably when I write to you about writing an essay, I usually end them with a sentence about Zidane or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. It's a common language. So I guess I miss that. I miss that friendship. I miss that element of connection, that common language that football has become around the world. And I miss the aesthetics, I guess, the pleasure, the aesthetic pleasure watching great football. I'm a fan of a team that used to be good in the 1920s. Since then hasn't done much. So I have become accustomed to watch at least two games. One is my own team, which is sometimes I watch while I try to do something else to avoid too much pain. But also that allows me to watch some good games. And I decided, for sake of my, you know, my work and my scholarship, to focus on Italian and British, and English championship. But, you know, I try to keep an eye on everybody else. So I guess these are the three things that I miss. I miss the friendship. I miss the language. The paratext around football, and I miss the actual aesthetic pleasure of it.
So Genova is was struggling last year, if I remember correctly. They were about to be relegated, right? So the relationship to relegation this year is different from the previous year, and it bears reminding the audience that Genova at some point was a great team. That did not need.
Yeah, first of all, it's Genoa, not Genova. Genova is the city in Italian. The club was founded by a British, an Englishman. That's why it's called Genoa. And that's why it's called Cricket and Football Club, which now all Genoa fans sort of utter with great enjoyment. But it's also, it's the oldest football team in Italy, or at least that's how the story goes. And yes, we haven't been doing well for the past 50, 60 year. So we were on the verge of relegation last year. We basically saved us at the last minute, and this year we were doing pretty badly. So
this, you know, this kind of leads me to talk about, you know, football as something that is other than just, you know, a sport that is being impacted by the pandemic, right? I think, you know, there's only so much that we can say about, you know, about what comes after the pandemic. When are we going to go back to the stadiums? When are we going to be able to, you know, be glued in front of our television, you know, every Saturday and Sunday to watch games? We will get back to it, certainly, but I wanted to just talk about, you know, about this in an indirect way, right? So to try to think about the kind of addiction. You said that we were not fanatics, but we might be addicted to it. And I certainly, I plead guilty to this one. And so for me, this world without football, this idea of a world without football, is an invitation to also talk about football as a medium of sorts, okay? And here, I've been thinking a lot about Marshall McLuhan these days. I mean, we are, you know, studying that in one of my classes, in my media anthropology class. But, you know, Marshall McLuhan said something quite interesting. He says that, you know, media are never neutral, right? And they always do something to us that is unknown to us, right? So there's this something enigmatic, right, and mysterious that media do to us. And I'm just trying to understand why am I, and many of us are, missing football in a way that I think invites us to think about the medium itself, right? So Marshall McLuhan has this distinction between hot media and then cool media. It's a counterintuitive, you know, kind of, you know, dialectic, right? So hot media are non-participatory, they are purely visual and so on. So that's cinema, that's, even radio to a certain extent is a hot media for him, which is kind of an oddity to me. And then you have cool media that are participatory, they're tactile, they're anti-visual and so on, right? So it seems to me that this kind of tension between hot and cool media is at stake in the way we miss football itself, right? So we miss this kind of dual, you know, kind of tendency of kind of a McLuhan-esque understanding of what a medium is. So when we say that we are addicted, we are, you know, you said that we are missing the aesthetic experience of football, right? But an aesthetic experience is mediated, right? And, you know, when we'll talk about Pasolini, you know, when he mentions that, you know, the ball is the medium, right? That kind of enables soccer players or football players to write poetry or prose on the field, right? So for us, what is the medium through which we experience football before and during this pandemic?
Well, so I have a friend who is addicted and who is actually sharing my subscription to, I'm not going to mention it, but an important platform that show all sort of football from around the world. And what he has been doing lately has been watching old matches. And I have been asking around, and this is in fact what is happening. Lots of people are in fact watching the classic. I think you're doing the same thing too, right? Everybody's sort of, so for example, today was supposed to be Derby Day in Genoa. So it was to be the Genoa-Sampdoria Derby. And I have received like 5 WhatsApp messages with, you know, momentous goals from the history of the Derby. Obviously, everybody is missing that moment, is missing that engagement. So I guess right now we are enjoying football in a very bizarre way. We are in the realm of the archive. Mm-hmm. You know, with everything that the archive does to you, I presume that a lot of people are rewriting narrative from themselves, particularly coming from bad teams. I'm pretty sure people are thinking of horrible campaigns, what were horrible campaigns in the memory and through the archive that we generate for ourselves, these moments become wonderful. Also, you know, there are platforms like YouTube and others recognize or try to recognize an algorithm of you, right? You are an algorithm. So if you type, you know, Zidane goals, you're going to see only Zidane goals. So, you know, even if Zidane had a bad moment, it's going to be forgotten in the algorithm, this bizarre way in which YouTube and other platform archive material in order to please you, right? the pleasure of that the algorithm is supposed to provide you. So I guess this is how most people I know are enjoying it, through, I guess, a rewriting, if I have to put it in one sentence, a rewriting of one's own archival memories of famous soccer moments.
So I don't think it's possible for me to imagine a world without football. Football for me is Al Ahli. It's the team that my family has always supported, whose small and big victories had our family house vibrate from all the stomping and shouting, and the car honks down the street, and the screams from the cafes scattered around the neighborhood. To give a little bit of a context on Al Ahli, it's an Egyptian football team based in Egypt's capital, Cairo, and it is known as the club of the century in the African football. Al Ahli won around 41 Egyptian Premier League titles and 36 national cups and 11 national super cups. And Egypt's mostly split between the two most famous teams, Al Ahli and Zamalek. And I honestly can't imagine a world without football. I'd say it would be such a dark and gloomy thought for me. Because the ways in which football matches matter and occupy a central position in my life, whether the Egyptian Premier League matches, for example, or even the English Premier League ones, where we get to watch Mohamed Salah, it all indicates that football, you know, occupies such a unique place in my everyday, in our everyday, in our social worlds, in our imaginaries as well. It's like one of those things, you know, on the list of things that quicken the heart, as Chris Marker would say. In many ways, the pace, the rhythm, the spirit, the electricity, the vibrance of football are such stimulants of life. And there's something very generative in football, I would say, that grows out of the thrill, you know, the anticipation, the hope, or even the frustration, or even those moments of teeth-grinding anxiety while monitoring matches results, or the attachment that we have to the players, to the very experience of following and paying attention to the game. It's a love story par excellence, I guess. It has a history for me that's deeply rooted in my memories of my childhood and adolescence as well. And it also sort of has a larger than life presence in my everyday till this moment. So I am waiting with much enthusiasm. I am waiting for the coming encounter with football, the coming match. And I can already sense the thrill by just imagining the first Ahli match that will or shall be played in the new world of COVID-19.
¡Vamos, Roberto! ¡Vamos, Roberto! ¡Le va a poner Roberto! ¡Va a poner Roberto! ¡Ahí está Zinedine! ¡Zinedine en gatilla! ¡Chuta! ¡Gol!
Yeah, so this, I mean, you know, just to go back to the Zidane moments that you just mentioned, usually the one that pops up, because I've been, you know, I'm a big fan of Zidane, both player and coach. In fact, my relationship to football is one in which although there are clubs that I feel very, you know, kind of strongly about, but I usually follow players, right? So I happen to like Inter Milan as much as Real Madrid, for the very simple reason that Ronaldo played in, you know, in those clubs. Ronaldo, the phenomenon, right? The Brazilian Ronaldo. So I think that YouTube, I think even video games, I mean, I see my son Sammy, who's continuously, you know, connecting with his friends through video games. So it definitely gives him a sense of community, a sense of being connected with his friends. And I certainly join in and play with him. And then sometimes we even try to recreate certain actions that we've seen on YouTube through the archive that you just mentioned, right? So sometimes we replay classic games, right? I mean, all of this sounds very silly, but to me, it's not at all. We take very seriously those games. So the next point that I wanted to raise with you, in addition to this kind of reflection on kind of the reflection on medium, hot medium, cool medium, perhaps the fact that we are not participating, or we are participating to a world without football in a way different than we were participating to a world with football, I think it's making the medium perhaps hotter in McLuhan's term. There's a lesser degree of participation somehow, and it's less tactile, especially if you are also is kind of a football player yourself, right? I mean, so I happen to play every week, right, with a group of friends, and we're all, you know, kind of out of shape and so on. But nonetheless, there is this kind of, you know, looking forward to touching that ball and being with friends and, you know, kind of tackling each other in a very friendly way. So the other point is the division between work and leisure. And I'm not sure where I'm going with this argument, but I certainly, you know, I show the man with the movie camera often in class. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with this is the great 1929 film by the Soviet filmmaker Dziga Vertov, who was, you know, inventing and manufacturing a new communist vision for a utopian future in 1920s Soviet Union, within the revolutionary culture of the time. And the film is divided, and this leads me to the question of the ritual, and will lead me to Pasolini eventually. So the film is divided into kind of these three scenes, right? There is the scene where the city is dormant and everyone is asleep, and then suddenly, you know, the city wakes up to life, and then you have this kind of working life, the life of labor. And then the first part is just about labor. And that part is in turn divided into two parts. So you have births and then deaths. Then you have divorce and marriage, wedding ceremonies and so on. So you have this kind of almost structuralist dualisms that kind of norm the film text itself. And then the second part is all about sport and leisure, right? So you have swimmers, you have athletes who are throwing the javelot, then you have this kind of divers, and all of this is recorded by the camera. So I'm just wondering whether the way we are addicted to soccer, right, in a way what does it do to this division between work and leisure, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does it still have the same function as a bridge between these kind of radically separated areas of life, right, that capitalism kind of polarizes in terms that are at times intolerable, right? So there's a time to play and then there's a time to work. How does it work for you, right, this division?
Well, you're talking about the pandemic, I presume, right?
Yes. What kind
of... I think Vertov is a very good start because, first of all, you have to remember when Vertov made that film, he was 30 years old. He was a kid. And with his brothers, they basically got some money and made a crazy film about how the future should be or how they saw the future. And I think it's still relevant for many reasons. I think, unfortunately, the pandemic brought up the more satirical aspect of cinema. So I think Jacques Tati playtime is maybe more appropriate for this. The problem with, or the issue with Jacques, with the film, with playtime, was that it started off with this strong division between leisure, play, and work, and then at the end of, and in which the poor protagonist of the film seems to be unable to enter into the workforce, into the French workforce of the new modernist, the new modern and capitalist France, so that at the end of the film, leisure, play, and work become one thing. So there is a big confusion at the end of the film. I don't know if you remember, in which nobody knows who is working and who is the tourist, who is having fun and who is working and who has a job and who doesn't. So I think we're a little bit there. And of course, I'm speaking like you from the position of having a job and having a salary, which luckily we both have. I mean, hopefully it will last for, I don't know how much this is going to last, since already we are hearing of adjunct faculty being fired and temporary faculty not being renewed. So, but luckily you and I have, in the ivory tower of academia, we are salaried. So we have actually that advantage of not having to worry about our daily sustenance. And therefore, we are trying to do, like you said, to do our job in this bizarre condition in which our children are here, the rest of our families around. And so you're trying to artificially recreate the division between work and play. But most of the time, the two things come together, like you said. So oftentimes, I am playing with my child while I'm working at the same time. And at the end of the day, I don't know if I worked or I played all day. Yeah. The idea of football, in this case, is kind of interesting. If you look at newspaper, I like to read local papers more than others. Particularly, I like to read my own, the local paper from my hometown, just because of a sort of a silliness of it. And it has still a sports section. And there's always an article about the two football teams. But this time, rather than being about whatever they did on the field, it's either a family portrait. So this is obviously stuff written by PR people, right? So what a great father this guy is, you know, or what a great family this guy has. All these sort of, you know, fake narrative. Or pseudo sci-fi almost stories of buy new players, selling new players, this old market that it's so much part of the fantasy of football and that now literally doesn't exist. So the sort of the speculative fiction that surrounds the actual played football and that there is so much part of it has now reached levels of true science fiction. Literally, we are talking about things that are not happening, that do not exist, and that nobody knows what whenever they will come back.
Within anthropology, I'm particularly interested in the work of Marc Auger, who's written on the French on the success of the French national team in 1998, and has written about football through a series of analogies, and he's even skeptical about some of the analogies that he makes. And one of these analogies is that football is a religion, right? That we all have, you know, our favorite clubs, and then these clubs have a sacred status in our lives, and then we are willing to, you know, give our lives to them. But I, in general, I do not think that that football is well served when critics makes this analogy with religion. In my view, it has a different, I think football has implies a different notion of addiction, right? So now you, I think you see where I'm going with this. I think it has a different notion of addiction behind it. I don't think that football is addictive in the sense that it's the opium of the people, for example. So that's one narrative, right? The other narrative is that it's addictive because it's also a terrain on which ideology, right, is inscribed, right? So Real Madrid are the fascists, Barcelona are the republicans and the anarchists, Napoli is the south, La Juve is the north, right? La UNAM in Mexico City is the emblem of the student movement in Mexico, whereas the Americas and the Chivas of Guadalajara are big business teams, right? So in these accounts, it seems to me that we are, you know, as spectators and football lovers, always kind of invariably duped by something, and that we do not have agency. So how would Pasolini's notion that football is the last sacred ritual relate to these accounts, and how would he be critical of these accounts?
Well, so, the problem with Pasolini in general is that, since you mentioned Vertov, I'm going to say Eisenstein had the same problem. These are artists who are their best critics. That is to say, these people, both Pasolini and Eisenstein, produce as much creative work as critical work on their own work. So they are the best critics. So it's very easy, for example, to become a Pasolini scholar or a Eisenstein scholar, because basically the work is already done for you. As opposed to many other artists, I don't know, some Antonioni, for example, or Lynch, who do not engage or engage remotely, or Bergman. I'm currently involved in a retrospective of Ingmar Bergman that decided that it was the moment, right? Since I have Criterion Channel here. The interviews are ludicrous. He talks about his film mentioning old Chinese tales in order to explain them. So they're not really explanation there. They add something to it, but they don't really do that critical work. So Pasolini is the best critic of himself, and he was very proud of it. And he basically conditioned and guided the criticism on his work by saying, oh, this film is definitely about the mythical origin of, you know, Greek civilization. So he was basically feeding, like every good PR person, what he wanted to say. So what, you know, in old school literary criticism, we used to call intentio autoris, right? The intention of the author is made clear by Pasolini at every point in time. So it's kind of interesting to then look at Pasolini otherwise. That is to say, starting by not by not believing what he says, but by putting the criticism that Pasolini writes of his own work into and as part of his work. That is to say, the text and the paratext, to use old terminology, are one. So if you look at any Pasolini's films and you want to write something, you're interested in writing about Pasolini, it's interesting not to read and consider Pasolini criticism of his films as criticism, but as somehow part of the film, in the way in which, for example, you look at a poster of a film to understand how it was distributed. That is to say, as paratextual elements. So I'm saying this because I know the text that you mentioned, and Pasolini was an avid player. He basically spent his mornings working, and he was a kind of a workaholic, we would say nowadays, if you think how much he produced throughout his life. And then every day at 2, he was on the pitch playing, and not mostly with Ninetto, his friend and actor of his film and collaborator. and he basically played soccer every day of his life. He was also always ready to play. That's something that everybody tells. You know, if there was a ball, no matter if he was wearing a suit, and there are a lot of pictures of Pasolini wearing suits playing, like he could not resist. He had this urgency of playing. One of the funny story, for example, is that there are different accounts whether he played left or right forward, which is also kind of interesting because in different interview he claimed to be the one of the best non-professional right or left forwards in Italy, and he was, as you know, Pasolini had very little self-irony and took himself very seriously, so he was notorious for getting mad on the soccer pitch and yelling at people. The most famous story is probably the one in which there was a derby going on between Bertolucci's crew that was shooting Novecento and Pasolini's crew shooting Salò, and so they were next to each other. They organized a soccer game, and Pasolini left because nobody was passing him the ball. Right? He was a resentful player, like we know many. I've met so many on the pitch, people that needed to be protagonists. So he wasn't playing. He was also very, very upset about losing. So he wasn't playing for the joy of playing. He was playing for winning. He was playing to be at the center of attention. And he was playing to beat the adversary, which is part of, you know, the sort of general, let's call it, using an old term, sadomasochism of Pasolini's approach to life. So when Pasolini says that soccer is the last ritual, it seems to me that he's feeding these to the audience that was reading this. It was written for a popular paper in Italy. It seems to me that it's something, I don't know if you believe that. I don't think Pasolini was a spectator. As far as I know, there's no mention of Pasolini at a stadium watching a game. Mm. For him, soccer was a way to, first of all, physical activity, because he was a physical person. Two, let's not forget, it was a way to meet and pick up boys and men in the outskirts of Rome. So it was a vehicle towards that. So the sentence that you mentioned in which soccer was one of the few best pleasure along with literature and sex, they're not to be seen separate. They are the same thing. So soccer, sex, and literature is the same thing for Pasolini in the sense that the one leads to the other and the other leads to the next, right? So there is this connection that it's very important. When he writes that it's a religion, my personal reading is that it's a religion for the others, for the kind of the people that go to the stadium, not for him. So it's not that he's expressing his own heartfelt emotion or feelings about soccer. I think he's trying to be a kind of a, the Italian expression would be Sunday sociologist or Sunday anthropologist, right? In which express a kind of a banal idea. I mean, come on, how banal is to say that soccer is a religion? I mean, what is not a religion then? Is like concert halls a religion? Is rock a religion? I mean, everything then is a religion. If by religion you mean large group of people joining together into a single-minded or a single-purpose action. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that defining soccer religion is bad for religion and bad for soccer. And partly, I mean, what does it add to claim that soccer is a religion? What does it add to soccer? I mean, soccer is, of course, from a strict Marxist point of view, and I'm happy you mentioned the opium of the people. You know, from a strict point of view, right now, soccer is mostly a business. And even in the past, I would say 20 years, the opening of the British of the English championship to foreign owners and the selling of rights to the world has radically, radically changed soccer, even from the time in which we were kids. So there's nothing quaint about it. And most people like us try to project some sort of authenticity into it. But the major axis right now of international football is money. I mean, it has become a way for massive corporations to recycle money. It has become a way to enrich themselves. More and more owners and managers, I would say owners of teams, are just businessmen who use this to profit from it. So it is the fan that turned all this dirty business into something a little bit better. So, you know, what's the relationship then to religion, right? Religion, if you think of religion as structured spirituality, a way in which people follow certain spiritual practices in a structured way, sure, yes, I mean, in a way it can be, but I don't see what that would add. And I'm a little surprised that Auger fell into that trap, because, you know, who wouldn't say that soccer is a religion when we have thousands of people congregating, particularly if you think about it, in Italy it happens on Sunday, or used to at least, right? So yeah. The same, you go to mass and then you go to see your local team. So I don't find it a productive metaphor at all. I mean, if I have to think of soccer as something, I would say that it's a business. It's a distribution scheme, if you like. And then it is a sense of place in the globalized world. So that's why I was thinking of Auger, who wrote so much about known places. Mm-hmm. I mean, soccer is a place. You know, it's the stadium in that spot in which you go to, either physically or through the medium of, you know, television or whatever it is now, that you go there. So, I don't know, geographical or spatial metaphor seems to me more appropriate to describe football.
I agree with you. And I would like to add also that I think Pasolini, I don't think he mentions the word religion. He says sacred ritual, which might be, you know, interpreted as being, you know, kind of equivalent to religion. It's the word sacred that really drew my attention.
If I can tell you, you know, Pasolini was also very idiosyncratic about the use of certain terms. Okay. So sacred for Pasolini had nothing to do with religion.
That's what I thought. So yeah,
the Catholic Church, but it had to do with some sort of mythical past, usually connected with the pre-modern world, the world before capitalism. He has a word that comes back often in Pasolini, which is irrealtà, unreality or non-reality, right? Mm-hmm. So he's eager to find this place where things were still real. You know, let's say the world before the society of the spectacle, right? The world before Gideboard. This is an undefined space that often becomes political, often not, but anyway, this is what sacred means to him. Not so much that has to do with religion. Also, I think that what he means by that is the actual people, like the people playing soccer, not soccer the business. As I said, I don't think he was a spectator. I don't think he used to go to see games. I don't even think he had a team. I think he was a Bologna supporter, but yes. I don't know how much he cared about that. So it seems to me that when he talks about sacred, he talks about kids playing in the outskirts of Rome, that coming together, that has something primitive, to use another word that Pasolini likes a word, primitive, ancestral, old, pre-modern group of boys playing in the dirt kind of thing.
certaines époques, dans certaines sociétés, le théâtre a eu une grande fonction sociale. Il rassemblait toute la cité dans une expérience commune, la connaissance de ses propres passions. Aujourd'hui, cette fonction, c'est le sport qui, à sa manière, la détient. Seulement, la cité a grandi, ce n'est plus une ville, c'est un pays, souvent même, pour ainsi dire, le monde entier. Le sport est une grande institution moderne jetée dans les formes ancestrales du spectacle. Pourquoi ? Pourquoi aimer le sport ? Il faut d'abord se rappeler que tout ce qui arrive aux joueurs arrive aussi aux spectateurs. Mais alors qu'au théâtre, le spectateur n'est qu'un voyeur, dans le sport, c'est un acteur. Et puis dans le sport, l'homme n'affronte pas l'homme directement. Il y a entre eux un intermédiaire, un enjeu, machine, disque ou ballon. Et cette chose est le symbole même des choses. C'est pour la posséder, la maîtriser, que l'on est fort, adroit, courageux.
But it's certainly difficult to make good film about football. I don't know if you have any good film about football that you can think of, apart from, you know, art pieces like Zidane, a 21st century player, which obviously it's a major achievement. But it's difficult to find good films about football. And the one you mentioned, it's kind of interesting because instead there are a lot of comedies in Italy about football. I Maghi del Pallone, the magician of football that you mentioned. There's probably the most famous one is called L'Allenatore nel Pallone, which features a famous southern Italian comedian who developed a 5-5-5 playing model. And it's often quoted even now in the news and in generally speaking, precisely to signify like a bad coach. Is the name of the character is Oronzo Cana, and they're playing all by these sort of minor Italian actors in the late 70s, 80s. So it's kind of interesting that somehow the most successful film, at least in Italy, were comedies about football rather than dramas, which would go against precisely the theory that somehow soccer is a religion. Because you can say that the best film about religion are comedies. So there is a comedy aspect that comes from it, and that comes from the medialization of football, right? We don't really experience football, most of us. We experience the mediatic version of it with, you know, the commentators and the interviews and the massive apparatus that soccer comes with. So I think that the reason why it works better in comedy is because most of us have been laughing at a lot of these experts, or supposedly so, that comments on the game and that usually end up saying the most banal things or the pompous coach who comes up with the new, you know, revolutionary theory that it, and that it's going to change the game forever, right? So in a way, I think that the reason why comedy works so well is because we're so used to be bombarded with mediated version of football that once, you know, we can laugh at them rather than having to actually believe what they say, mm-hmm. Is a good way around.
I think there is one excellent essay film on sports, which has one section on football. And in fact, it's a film that comes from Canada. It's a production by the National Film Board in 1961. It's a collaboration between a Canadian filmmaker, whose name is escaping me right now, and Roland Barthes. And it culminated in a book called What is Sport, right? And the film was called Le Sport et les Hommes, okay? Sport and Men. And it's a very beautiful reflection on this enigmatic thing we call sport, the way we love sport, the way the human drama is played out in sports, but more importantly, the way Barthes talks in particular about the notion of style. And what I find interesting about the relationship between art and football is precisely this notion of style. Okay, and Barthes, when he talks about the torero style in particular, he says, what is a style? And he says, style makes a difficult action into a graceful gesture. And he introduces a rhythm into fatality. Okay, style is to be courageous without disorder, to give necessity the appearance of freedom, right? So it has to be this effortless kind of performance. Courage, knowledge, beauty, these are what man opposes to the strength of the animal. That is the human ordeal, of which the bull's death will be the price. And then, you know, in the final section, when the voiceover returns to the question of style, Barthes links theatrical performance to the style of the football player in particular. So that's a film that, you know, will be a segment in the show today at some point. But I want to return to what you were saying about, you know, films. And indeed, I find that there are dozens of films, artworks, and even curatorial projects now on around football, right? So there is this, there is Football, the Beautiful Game at the LACMA in 2004, I believe, 2014, in which the films that you cited were screened, but also some installations by Harun Farouki. Then there is the Parreno, Zidane Portrait of a 21st Century. And then there is this excellent video by the Mexican visual artist Miguel Calderon. So it's called Brazil versus Mexico, okay? And it stages an impossible victory where Mexico beats Brazil 17-0, right? And so what he did, what Calderon did, he secretly placed a TV set in a bar in Sao Paulo where he was, to attend the Sao Paulo Biennale. And then a certain moment, an announced, there's a soccer match that appears on the screen, and then suddenly Mexico is beating Brazil 1-2-3-4-6-7-0. And, so it's a kind of a fake documentary of sorts, right? A fake video in which the impossible happens. But at the same time, it's a critique of Mexican nationalism. And then, of course, Brazilian nationalism at the same time. It's kind of love that we have with our national teams. So that's one example that I find interesting. But the one that I really enjoyed recently is precisely the Netflix television series that you introduced me to, Sutherland Till I Die, because this is not the world of wealthy, football teams. We're talking about a team that was promoted to the Premier League, right? And then after a first positive season, if I remember correctly, suddenly everything turns into a nightmare, right? And that to me is what football is about. It's about the You Never Walk Alone of Liverpool, right? Where your fans are unconditionally, supporting you, right? But there are various tribulations that take place during that season, right?
Sunderland is a old team. At the very first painting that shows a soccer team shows Sunderland. Yeah. It's one of the most prestigious teams in the league. and with the long and impressive history that hasn't been doing well for more than 50 years now. But what happened is that the team was bought by one of these, you know, new owners. And what he did, he bought a he basically hired a TV crew to follow the renaissance of the team, right? Basically, they were in the champion. The second league is now called championship. They were in second league, and but basically, they were gonna have a new coach, new players, and it would have been a, you know, the history of a success. So it would have been the usual sport documentary that shows how commitment and the fans and the players and everybody, and as you said, the word Telos comes back, right? It would have been a Dante's trip from hell through purgatory into heaven, right? And we would end up being again in Premier League. What happened is that none of this happened. In fact, the first season, the entire first season of Sunderland Till I Die is a history of an incredible series of disastrous events, one after the other. The team keeps on losing. They change coach every 2-3 games. The fans are desperate. And and my question was, you know, why would you keep on shooting? What was going on? And the owner that hired this team kept on sort of hoping that something would happen, right? It's just that, you know, fate, going back to Pasolini and the Greeks, it's really this sort of doom and fate in the Greek sense of the term, that no matter what they try and do, they're going to fail, and that they're destined to failure. So to me, it was very exciting, because you rarely see pre-packaged product like a, as I said, paid soccer documentary on Netflix actually telling you an unexpected story, so showing you failure, showing you what everything that went wrong.
And you know what's interesting, and then we can conclude. I think that there is among the teams, the teams that are going to be more threatened in the context of this pandemic are precisely the teams of the Sunderland type, teams that are not only at the bottom of the Premier League or the kind of the major championships, right, but also second division teams, but also third and amateur teams in particular. And the relationship between amateur teams and professional teams is complicated ones, because my understanding, again, through Marc Onger's work, is that, at least in France, which is the country that he is talking about, historically, it was middle class and upper middle class who joined the amateur leagues, whereas professional teams were composed of working class players, son of miners, and so on. So I think the relationship between amateurism and professionalism is going to be amplified, you know, in the aftermath of this outbreak. But I think Sunderland and the kind of the topos of failure, which you've outlined, reminds me that there is always a residue of amateurism in professionalism to a certain extent. And I think Pasolini, it seems to me, stands a little bit for that. He might be, you know, a nasty, you know, colleague on the field and teammate. But nonetheless, I think there is this idea that that amateurism is not the amateurism of the middle class and the upper middle class that Marc Auger is talking about, but an amateurism that plays football for football's sake, right? And then football is not a religion, and football is not a philosophy, which is the other term, right? So when Pep Guardiola is being interviewed, so what is your philosophy of football, right? Or Mourinho, right? And then Guardiola is famous to answer, my philosophy is that you need to keep the ball. If you keep the ball, you know, you have more chances of scoring, and you have less chance of others scoring against you. Of course, it's more sophisticated. So neither religion, neither philosophy, Something else which I think we've been talking about, and that I think Pasolini's relationship to football enables us to think about, and that becomes amplified in the context of a world without football. So I'd like to thank you, Luca, for joining me today, and I'm sure that we will have many more conversations about this in the future.
Thank you, Tarek, for having me, and congratulations on your radio show.
Take care, and see you soon.